the topic is very large, so I hope that it will really work out in that fashion. What I want to talk about really is the nature of halakha as law, and how we should think about halakha as law. And I want to approach the question of how we should think about halakha as law in the context of two things that I think are often taken as methodological assumptions of what modern Orthodox should be, and we'll talk about that in the conference. And kind of just worried, I'm talking about halakha as law, so I should really sit down and let you talk. But we'll have the conversation somewhere in the middle. So two assumptions that are often made is that part of what would characterize modern Orthodox halakha is one is a notion that one is interested in historical as opposed to Masoretic truth of the texts, and that wants to paskin according to the original meaning of the Makorot, as opposed to the way the Makorot have developed over time. And a second possibility is that one has a very strong ethical presumption that the halakha should be much closer in accordance with one's conception of ethics than standing as an independent framework of values. Yes, Professor Sabin.
I think your second point is right, and I would frame it differently. Your first point will be right if it supports the second point, but if it doesn't support the second point, we'll be very happy interpretation.
So let's play that out, and we'll see. What I'm saying is, I think the conventional perception is that part of what characterizes modern Orthodox halacha are these two.
I want to deny that.
You want to claim it's even true that that's people's presumption?
Right.
I think that the presumption is.
Okay, let's have a vote. How many of you think that modern Orthodox halacha is right would decide according to historical truth? More likely to, right, or has a bias, or is even committed to paskening like the historical truth, as opposed to according to the truth, the way it appears at this point in history, let's say in the last 100 years. Right, that.
Is or should?
Say should.
All right, I would go with should. I'm not sure that is correct.
Anyone else want to vote?
Which question?
I would actually vote now.
Uh-huh.
I'm just thinking about Hanukkah right now. It's Hanukkah. But there are many things about Hanukkah that, at least how we celebrate, don't seem to be completely historically the way that it was. I mean, something without getting into any controversy, there's like kind of no way they ate latkes.
You have to read Yoni Applebaum.
Yeah. At that point, I just see it very strongly that we seem to care more about the tradition and how it's come to this point, more so than what the.
Okay, so we have positions both ways. I think it's really challenging question is developing a methodology, which is somewhere in between, saying that the halakha is as it appears to the 21st century, the most recent layer, and deciding what if you go back to what layer, right? I have friends, I'm sure you have friends who want to be Rambam Jews,
right.
Second Temple Jews, right? Then we get back to Karaites, right? So that's the.
Right. I'm not sure. Maybe it shouldn't be formulated as going back to historical truth, but at not necessarily. Like the issue of take Kolisha as an example. Lots of people would love to stay in the world of the Rishonim as opposed to the world of the Achronim, right? So that's an example. So it's like I think that's a better formulation. That there are many people who want to go look at different layers of the halakha rather than historical truth. Like, historical truth sounds like I'm saying.
So I think you're right that historical truth is a crude term because historical truth is never a viable framework in a legal context unless you pick a particular fixed point, right? If you're an absolute originalist, right? I want to know what the Constitution meant to those men in Philadelphia at that time, and then you get into the problem of the meaning of a text written by committee.
Right.
And halakha is written by committee, right? A committee that lasts 1,000 years. So I think that's correct. I think that is a challenge I think we keep trying to figure out that a reasonable characteristic of certain kinds of unorthodox halakha is the desire to be willing to go to prior layers of the tradition and to say, this has been understood this way for some time, but we go back there and we look at it, and the question is there anything more than just ad hoc saying we'll take take you know, your simplest way, we will undo the halakha of the past 100 to 400 years anytime that the halakha as it is doesn't appeal to us.
Right, exactly. I'm sorry, very kids.
I expect it to be lively.
Right,
meaning,
meaning, I think you're right. That some people within the modern Orthodox world, or you know, want to do that. But also, but what complicates matters is that even in non quote unquote modern Orthodox circles, there's the whole issue of psak in individual cases where we're willing to do that. Meaning, once you throw in shas adchak and you throw in extreme situations.
Yes, I want to be mechalik because those are right. built within the halacha always was to be shas adchak. You could pass in that right. way. Okay, what, do I have any idea what time I have until?
12:45.
12:45. Okay, so I'm going to try and put a couple of actual cases on the floor, and let's play it out. I guess I'll put one other. To me, like the reverse theoretical question is that once you allow certain kinds of say like this, once you allow yourself to say this was what halakha would have been 500 years ago, but somewhere along the line we made a mistake, and this is the halakha now. So you might say, okay, this is a very traditional position, a very conservative position, we're going to take the halakha the way it is. But the next stage always is, so why can't we misunderstand it the same way they did? Right? They engage in this kind of misunderstanding, so why can't we engage for... Right? And then we try and say, oh, there's a difference between self-consciousness and not self-consciousness, and then we all get into the postmodern vortex, and, right, and halakha gets swallowed. So I want to take a couple of examples to start with. Recognizing that at the outset I'm going to try to take the examples that will most upset people who want to believe in historical truth. So we'll say it's a very simple example. These are programmatic statements as opposed to concrete halakhic statements. So one is kochad heter adif. As people love quoting, right, koach heter adif, that the halakha, right, it takes more power to, right, more halakhic force to issue a lenient ruling than a strict ruling, and that's taken not only as a descriptive statement, but as a prescriptive statement, that one should, therefore, one should strive to be the kind of posek who is mekil as opposed to the kind of posek who is machmir. Now that, and usually when you see that, it'll be sort of like kochad heter adif, right, and then we quote the Gemara. But the problem is that the... Yes, sure. But if we're talking as an academic, right? And I got interested in this first as an academic, as a graduate student. It was one of my first papers. What does koach teter adif mean in the Gemara? So the first thing you discover is that the case where you all learned it is a case in Beitza, Daf Bet Amud Bet, where the Gemara is trying to ask the question why the Mishnah presents a particular machloket Beit Hillel and Beit Shammah in a particular way. Why do you present this case and not that case? And the answer is it presents this case. Because this is the case that shows the extreme of the Mekil position, which is the position of Beit Shammai. Okay, so it can't be. Whatever you want the Gemara to mean, it cannot mean that we paskin like Koach Teter Adif means that the Matir has more halachic power because the Matir, the Mekil is Beit Shammai, and Koach Teter Adif means that the Mishnah prefers to present the extreme of the position of Beit Shammai as opposed to the extreme of the position of Beit Hillel. So that's A. Right, so whatever kochad etera adif means, it doesn't mean that the. So halacha kedivrei mekel. There are other issues where we have similar types of notions, but kochad etera adif, we could. Right, if you want to really, as graduate students, will point out that actually, even the statement in Beitza that the Gemara, that the Mishnah prefers to show the position of the mekel over the position of the machmir is not true either. That if you go through all the examples of Lodiecha Kocho de Rabbi so and so in the Gemara, there are more that show the position of the Machmir than the position of the Mekil, and it's not clear that there's any coherent way to make sense of that statement at all. But the one thing we know is that since it's the position of Beit Shammai, it has no relevance whatsoever to halachic force. Rav Sherlo mentions that halacha kedivrei hamekil is a much more interesting question, and I love using to my students as an example, because if you take that as a given, so then all machlokasim are pointless. Right, it's just a race, right? I see your kula and I raise you one, right? I win, ha! Oh no, I can be more given than that. I win, right? I win that too, right? We'll have all those. Right? So obviously, halakha has to function on something a little bit more sophisticated than the position simply that the most mekil position always wins. right? Otherwise, all our evidence, all our arguments are wasted. Where arguments would begin with such a strong presumption, right? That if you have a more mekel position in avilut or an eruvin than I do, I have to show you not only that your position is wrong, but it's ridiculous. Right? And that's not, I think that's not a fair description of the way the halacha has functioned. That there's ever a burden of proof that strong, that ridiculousness is anything not ridiculous wins. Okay, the other example I want to quote, which is famous here from Professor Jacob Katz, is Yisrael Achal Pisha Chata Yisrael. So Jacob Katz has a very famous article in which he shows, I think compellingly, that Yisrael Achal Pisha Chata Yisrael Hu in the Gemara refers to Klal Yisrael and has no relationship to individuals. But Rashi adapts it to individuals, and then it becomes a very powerful halachic force, which has enormous impact halachically. Now, it might be impact halachically that we're not so happy about, because the impact halachically is to create agunas, right? Because it means that kedushay mumar require a get. But nonetheless, all of us have the cockles of our hearts are warmed by the notion that once a Jew, always a Jew, and nothing you can do can deprive you of the statement, right, of the status of a Jew, even though it's not true historically. Right, and then the interesting analog to think about nowadays is the phrase tikkun olam. Right, so the contemporary use of the phrase tikkun olam to equate to certain liberal conceptions of what social justice means is at least as far, but maybe not further from the truth, than the use of koch deter adif to mean that the mekel position wins halachically, or Yisrael afa pi shechata Yisrael hu means that once a Jew, always a Jew. So right now, as somebody who is violently opposed to that use of the term tikkun olam,
this is all over the law.
Right?
For instance,
Ken?
In order to so mitzvah, ba'avirah, you have to be a great talmid chacham. It should be the same time and the same and independent. And we use the term mitzvah, ba'avirah, dafka la'achmir. In much further cases that we were using, or uzdin dechol, or kol mine dvarim kele. We have this phenomenon everywhere. It's not, and we should check. Are we making a mistake, or are we using the phrase and we are aware that it's a completely different thing, or whatever? I mean,
so we can argue.
There is a process where really the main idea, Kiddush Hashem. Okay? Kiddush Hashem or Chilul Hashem is Shvua. It's related to Shvua. So, and we use Kiddush Hashem, as a white phrase, so maybe it's
So I think that's a fair question.
If you're playing to another audience, you talk about seeds.
Yeah.
If you're playing to another audience, you would say, look, where's what's in me? Let's say, look, you mentioned Lakeha, and you're right, and now it's become this whole. Right? So the point is, then we can take this further. Every Midrash Halakha has this problem. Every Midrash, right? It's sort of like, you can't do step one.
Okay, so liberal Russian maskimitcha al the rational mitzvah baba vera. The same vera as the anime of the Chidush of Rav Rabinovich.
No, without Rav Rabinovich.
Ah, okay, so
literally is not to put a stone in someone in front of the
Okay, so
and Chazal Uked to a Tzashin Ahoged.
Okay, so good. So everyone. So one fair question is, didn't Chazal do the same thing? So we're just picking an arbitrary point in history at which we say, at this point you can change the meanings, right? Chazal could change the meanings, the Maram could change the meanings, the Rishonim could change the meanings, but we can't, right? And it's really being arbitrary. But I think we always have to address that question, right? Is that fair? And I happen to think that on this issue, and Lifnei V'Ol Zotein Michshol, and many other issues that I don't agree about Midrash Halacha either. I'm very, very firm about such things. I think that the traditional meaning through Chazal is probably the emes, the vast majority of the time, and the attempts to read, this is my own academic position, that attempts to read a text against a live tradition are almost always less good than reading a text in the context of a live tradition. So I always write against the notion that 12th century Lutheranism is a more accurate understanding of of Chumash than Chazal, right? We don't believe in Sura Sola Scriptura. The Rashbam. The Rashbam is a 12th century Lutheran, right? Sola Scriptura. If you really believe that, that's what he is. So I have my own positions about this. Okay, let's go to actually straight Gemara. Okay, I hope this isn't too much inside baseball. Sorry. Okay. So let's.
As ex-Protestant, I really appreciate that level of flexibility.
Okay. So the Gemara of Ezra. Here's a concrete halachic context. Gemara of Ezra says, "Lifnei dehenshul of dekochavim shloshayamim asur l'teit l'teit imahem." 3 days before the holidays of 3 days before the holidays of the idolaters, we'll leave aside who the idolaters are. You're not allowed to engage in any kind of commerce with them, whether as a buyer or a seller. So the Gemara says, "Yibayilhu mishum harvacha, odilma mishum lifnei iver lo sitein michshol." Why would you be prohibited to engage in commerce today? Let's say, right, with whoever you happen to believe are idolaters who actually, right, who have a holiday on December 25th. Whether you believe anyone fits in that category or not. Let's assume that you do the sun worshippers, whatever. On the solstice, whatever it may be. So the Gemara says there are two possible rationales. One possible rationale is Mishum Harvacha, which we'll assume means that we're afraid that if you engage in commerce, they will go thank their idol for enabling this commerce. So you are, in some way, you are violating a direct prohibition of Lo Yishama Al Picha, that you cannot cause people to mention the names of other gods in religious contexts. The other possibility is Mishum Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol, is that you're placing a stumbling block in front of the blind. So the issue is not that you caused the name of another god to be mentioned. The issue is that you caused another human being to engage in an idolatrous practice. Right? It's not your responsibility for the act, it's your responsibility for the person. Okay, so the Gemara says, L'may nafkamina, who cares? It sounds like basically it's always going to end up being the same thing, right? Because you can't have an act without a person. Right. So the answer is the nafkamina is the itle behema di day. So we're talking about a case where we have to put in facts. Which first of all, we're talking about a case assumption that the commerce engaged in is selling an animal that is a potentially valid sacrificial animal, and so therefore, right. So in that case, we'd say, well, if the commerce is advantageous, so look, he bought a cow and she bought a cow. Right, and they're happy about it, right? So they'll go thank their god. But if you're worried that what you're doing is, by selling them a cow, you're enabling them to go off and engage in a particular idolatrous practice of sacrificing this animal, so they have an animal already, they don't need your cow. So the implication is it's fine to sell idolatrous cows as long as they already have enough cows to meet whatever their sacrificial obligations are. So the Gemara says, "V'chi itle lo ovar mishum lifnei iver lo sitein michshol." Is it really true that if they already have a cow, that selling them another cow, even though they might use your cow, right? They might sacrifice your cow and not their original cow. So really, in the end, you are participating in their action because this was your cow, Bessie, and your cow, Bessie, is now idolatrous sacrifice, Bessie. So you're still participating. So the Gemara, right? Is it really true that's not enough? Because Amar Rabbi Natan. How do we know that you shouldn't extend a cup of wine to a Nazir who has sworn not to drink it, or a limb torn from a live animal to a non-Jew? So this is an important text for religious obligations extending towards non-Jews. So the answer is, lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, that's considered metaphorically placing a stumbling block in front of the blind. Right, as Rav Shlomo mentioned, we could discuss whether the text was originally intended literally or was originally intended metaphorically. I take the position that it's plainly intended metaphorically from the start. Although there's a fun, interesting question among the Akronim then about whether you actually violate Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol if you place a stumbling block in front of a blind person. And then the particularly interesting Akronim is what happens if you place a stumbling block in front of a blind person and then remove it before he actually trips over it. Right? Have you violated the technical prohibition even though you... Right? And all sorts of fun questions you can have, right? You can have constructing that. Okay. So the Gemara says, why should this be a violation? V'ahacha b'hir, d'chi lo yehavinin le shakli ihu. If you didn't give the Nazir the cup of wine, it's not the only cup of wine in the world. If you didn't feed this Avram ben Achayev to the Ben Noach, look, there are lots of animals running around. You could probably catch one of them. So what are you doing? That's necessary in the practice. So the fact that Rabbi Natan says that you violate just by handing him a cup of wine suggests that we care about is whether you were involved in his sinning process and not about whether you enabled his sinning process. So interesting, our answer is Hachav v'mayaskinan. So what's the case here? Dekai betray ivri dinahara. That you and the Nazir or the non-Jew are on opposite sides of the river. Okay. So you only violate an Iver Lusitain Mikshol if you're on opposite sides of the river. Now this is understood by many of us, I think, in the, you know, start, which I think it has been the dominant understanding in all the Achronim, maybe the only understanding of all the Achronim, as meaning that this line basically reaffirms the previous line. And says that you only violate Lifnei Avir Lusitain Mikshol if your participation is essential to the sin. Right? But if you're living in a society where people are going around doing things that you believe are forbidden all the time, and therefore engaging in that society, if you take the strict position, right, it would mean that you could never do perfectly ordinary things. For example, you couldn't serve as a cashier in a supermarket because there are Jews. And the Jews will come, and they will try to buy basar b'chalav. Right? When a Jew comes to the supermarket aisle and says, "Here, I have here my pepperoni pizza," you will say, "No, I'm sorry, I cannot participate in your purchase of a pepperoni pizza." Right? So you can't take positions in any of these stores. Right? We'll end up basically. You will have to let alone engaging in part of the student leadership in a pluralistic Jewish community. Where you will be doing things that engage you with non-orthodox practices that you think are counter halacha. And all sorts of interesting cases you can set up. My program some years ago wrote Shuvot about the issue of whether you can arrange for the meeting space for an halachic minyan. Can you arrange for the candles to be set out even though you know that the Reform minyan will light the candles after sunset? Right, all sorts of issues like that. And the easy solution, which for those people who are interested in being able to function societally with people who don't share halachic commitment, is to say, Lifnei Avir Lusitain Mikshol means that it's only forbidden to participate, deoraita, if your participation is essential. Whenever they could do it without you, right? And that's what, right? Then, if you're in the Lundish world, we say, but there's a Tosfot somewhere who says there's a Dirabonan prohibition of Meseya, Yodei Avrei Avera, and then we go into a whole long, you know, things about, since it's only Dirabonan, right, here are 16 different ways to get out of, right, to get out of that Dirabonan. Okay. Let's take a look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Amarafuna, Katan Harudef Nitan Hatzilo Benafsho. If you have an under bar mitzvah child who is chasing someone else with intent to kill them, so you are allowed to shoot the underage child in order to save the victim, right? We have a bias towards victims over perpetrators. You can kill the perpetrator to save the victim. Again, we're dealing with a child. One should, for those of you already jumping to it, this doesn't include fetuses, and it probably doesn't include children without any volition. It's talking about minors with volition. And what the cutoff point is between a fetus that has no volition and a minor, you know, and an 11-year-old is beyond our ken. So Gemara says, okay, is this right? So what? Why does Rav Huna hold this? So Rav Huna must hold Rodev Ein Sarich Hatra'ah. Rav Huna must hold that the capacity to kill somebody trying to kill somebody else is not a judicial proceeding that requires you to formally state to the person before you kill them, know that the person you're about to kill, right, that you're about to violate such and such. Because whatever you say about a minor's capacity for intent, we don't assume that they are capable of receiving that kind of formal legal warning. Okay, so we have a problem in that we have a Braita, and the Braita says that in fact, if you see A trying to kill B, what you're supposed to do is shout at A, know that you're about to violate the prohibition of Vechadav, right? You know, right, and you can't kill him. The implication is you can't kill him until he has been mekabel hatra'ah. So isn't this a disproof to Rav Huna? So Gemara says, no, it's not a disproof to Rav Huna, because we're talking about a case where you and the Rodef are standing on opposite sides of the river. What does that change? It's like he's killing him without you. It doesn't need your help. Right? It's not talking about a case where the Rodef couldn't kill him without you. Right? The whole point is he's going to kill him unless you stop him. Wait one sec. Okay, one more Gemara. So Gemara in Bava Kamma talks about, we're dealing with the halachot of Moser, of handing somebody's property or person over to a repressive Gentile government. So the Gemara says, Hahu gavra dansu over to kochavim. There was a particular person who was coerced by idolaters. The achvi achmara of Mari, brother of Pinchas, brother of Chista. Right, and he showed them where the right, possibly these are tax collectors, whatever it may be, an assumption where we assume that the taxes are actually theft. So he shows them where somebody's wine is hidden, and then they say, "Take the wine with us." And he goes and he helps them carry the wine to the local, right, to the local bandit's house or tax collector's house, whatever it may be. So so the person whose wine is taken sues the informer. You showed them where my wine was hidden. And he goes to Rav Ashi, and Rav Ashi says he's pater. Rav Ashi says you don't have to pay. So the Gemara, at some point, Rav Yavo challenges Rav Ashi and says, "Amar lo anas." If the coercer said to you, "Hoshit li pakia amir ze or eshkol anavim ze," if the coercer says, "Hand me that cluster of grapes from so and so's vineyard, or that bale of hay from his vineyard," so right, he tells you this. You are chayav. So how can Rav Ashi say that you're exempt if you show somebody the wine when the Braita says explicitly that you're liable if you hand in the grapes? So which Gemara answers? We're talking about a case where they're on two sides of the river. So we have three cases where the Gemara resolves a situation by saying that the solution is they're on two sides of the river. So in the Lifnei Iver case, the psak that we basically live our lives by is that our help is essential. In the case of the Anas, the informer, we could understand it that way. We could say that what it means is that you're only liable if you hand over the grape in a situation where the coercer couldn't reach the grape themselves. But that's not a viable reading of the Sugya in Sanhedrin. So Rav Nachman Rabinovich argues, and there's a much more complex argument about this where he thinks, I'm not convinced, that Rabbeinu Chananel explicitly reads it this way, and then on the basis of showing that Rabbeinu Chananel reads it this way, he thinks, but I think the argument stands on its own right, that actually the majority of Rishonim read the Sugya entirely differently. And that the halakha as we have it is fundamentally an error. And the evidence is that the Rambam and many others don't quote this distinction about two sides of the river in the context of Lifnei Iver. So what does it really mean? What it really means is, in the case of the Rodef, of A trying to kill B, why does it matter that you're on opposite sides of the river? It doesn't mean that he doesn't need your help. It means that you can't force him to stop. So if you see somebody in the course of attempting murder, so your first obligation is to try to stop them, if necessary, by deadly force. If you can't do that, right, meaning that being on opposite sides of the river means that you can't coerce the person on the other side of the river to do what you want, then you give hatra. So Rabinovich argues that that's actually what it means in all the other cases also. When the Gemara says that the people are standing on opposite sides of the river, what it means is that therefore they can't coerce you. And therefore, when we say that you don't violate Lifnei Iver, right, when you're not on, you only violate Lifnei Iver when you're on opposite sides of the river, it means that you don't violate, the only case where you can be exempt from Lifnei Iver, the only case when you can participate in someone else's sin, is if you said no, they could force you. Right, so if you live in a society, right, where the sinning people have the capacity to compel your coercion, you don't have an obligation to resist. But that has nothing to do with, right, that if that were the standard, right, so let's forget Orthodox participation in Hillels. Right, nobody can force you to do anything.
Well, if you work there, then your boss can.
So it's an interesting question about whether if you voluntarily place, but students are not, right? Students have no coercive power at all, right? Whether you can serve, and the notion, you know, that you're serving there because, right, under force majeure, really, of course, you would find a job, right? Which, right, you know, it makes our whole, all such engagements bidiyavat.
So,
yeah.
Pardon? The problem with that reading is that,
yeah.
What is the mikshol that you're no pain?
What is the mikshol that you're no pain? You are you're enabling that, right, the nazir would not, right, the nazir.
You are not tackling him and ripping the wine out of his hand.
No, fakirs. You're handing him the wine. The only reason that you're exempt, if you're on two sides of the river, then you are liable. Because he couldn't force you. But the assumption is, the other case is, the only even if you're on the same side of the river,
right,
the only reason, you can only give him the wine,
right,
if he is stronger than you. If
he would have been able to force
you to give him the wine.
And he could take it himself.
So, let him take it himself. What are you doing handing it to him?
Then why raise that as an example?
So, the answer is, what grounds are you allowed to hand somebody else something? The answer is never, right? Unless, right, except that you don't have to resist, right? Even if he tells you do this, right, and he could force you, you say okay, right? You know, right? If he can force you, then you can, right? Then there's no obligation to resist. That's the only exception for lifnei according to this reading. So we can talk about whether it's true or not, right? I'm not interested in, for the purpose of this share, I'm going to tell you that I find this very convincing because of the example of Sanhedrin seems to me really very compelling. And now the question is, what should we do halachically if we find this reading convincing? I suppose you're right, you read it.
I'm sorry, yeah. Explain to me. So according to the accepted view, if we're on one side of the river, I cannot hand the Nazir the wine.
But if we're on the same side of the river, I always can. Anytime he could reach it himself.
Right.
According to Rabbi reading, even if he could reach it himself, that's not enough. He has to be able to force me to hand it to him. And that's what being on the same side of the river means, is that he has the capacity to coerce me. All right, so there are ways to resolve it. You can say either that you don't find the reading. The easiest way is to say, even though the Gemara uses the same phrase, right, in three different contexts, it means something different in the third context than the second. And then Rabinovich will say, okay, that's a nice shot in the Gemara, but in fact the Rambam doesn't quote this, and if you're right, he should. And in fact, once you notice the Rambam doesn't quote it, none of the other Rishonim quote it either. Many of the other Rishonim don't quote it, right? It's a whole long list. And by halachic weight, we would have a tough argument.
So I'm yes. Saying, why is this any different? This is kind of like the Halifni, you know, saying, Rava didn't understand, you know, the Mishnah, what the Mishnah really means, but I don't care, because halacha operates in its own universe, and I'm as frum as the next, you know, Sigur or Chassid, but I know that that's what the Gemara means. So,
I think that it's not so difficult to distinguish the Gemara from other places, leaving aside Fesra Livni's issue, but on the claim that what gives the Gemara authority is a particular canonical moment, at which point all its interpretations are enshrined, and we're only interested in what it meant. There is no such canonical moment unless you think the Shulchan Aruch is. So do we want to say, you know what, the reason that modern Orthodoxy isn't bound by this problematic reading of Lifnei Iver is because we are Shulchan Aruch Yidden, and we're not willing in any ways. I don't think we are, right? I think that we'd be very, very unwilling. I am very, very unwilling to take the Shulchan Aruch as a canonical moment that in any way resembles the Gemara.
I understand, but isn't that I don't understand. In the real world in which we live, we are really Shulchan. Meaning, yes, there are moments where we may take issue with it, like all folks do, but by and large, we are Shulchan Aruch, even in the modern Orthodox world.
What do you mean, we, Tanto?
Generally, the way I'm saying, yeah. When you learn Bishul, right? Think
yeah.
About it.
Yes.
Stay away from the controversial issues, right? Before we get to when you learn Bishul in Chevron, or you learn Bishul in Yeshivat Har Etzion, and you learn Bishul in YCT, by and large, 99.9% of the time, you're going to come to very similar conclusions about Bishul. You're still operating with the same categories of A Bishul, Achar Bishul, and what's a Kli Rishon, what's a Kli Sheni. So some people may be more makil, will use Kli Shlishi. But fundamentally, we're operating within the same orbit of halacha.
Well, I think part of that is because we're making, I think part of that is a conscious choice, and part of figuring out, you know, what are the consequences of taking that conscious choice and trying to be consistent. Part of it is, is not, the world could split very radically on that, right now, right? If you decide to paskin like the position that Rav Melamed has now mentioned as, as a bedieved, at least, that metals don't absorb. So basically, if the yeshiva which learns your idea, right? Let's say Rav Chaim Avadia in Washington, I think, has publicized something from the Sephardi Institute or something, which Rav Melamed now has taken seriously, right? That we really care about science. We really care about science, right? So a yeshiva that cares about science in that way, as opposed to the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch, will not have a Hilchus, right? Their Hilchus Kashrus will be further from each other than, than nameless yeshivot are on the question of whether women can have aliyot.
I'm just saying, I haven't seen that yet happen.
Not yet, but it could.
No, it's part of it happens in the big question, not in the small question, the issue. You are talking about abortions, talking about someone that says he doesn't want to live in a very bad disorder, and
right.
He doesn't want that anybody would take care of him.
Right.
And all those questions, there'll be a big gap between.
But there, we're still operating within the world of. So you're going to rely on the Tzitz Eliezer as opposed to Rav Moshe. You're still operating in a very similar.
So we're only 17 minutes left. I'm going to try and. All right. I think you're. What I'm trying to do is point out that what we do mostly is muddle through.
Right.
And then the problem with muddling through is that when people push the envelope one way or the other, it's very hard to come up with a clear explanation of why not. Everybody who cares about halacha. I'm not even going to set up orthodox boundaries on this, right? There,
And it's always a problem. It's only a modern assumption that there was some definitive answer before. They're doing the same thing that you're trying to do. They just did it a long time ago. They're trying to muddle through.
So it could be right. So I would say that it's often the case that. I think we should be suspicious of the notion that you can ever characterize any human activity in purely Brisker terms, that everybody actually follows bright line conceptual frameworks. But it doesn't mean that the attempt to provide some kind of definition isn't useful or necessary. And that comes up when somebody pushes the envelope one step further and you try and say, well, that's wrong. And you say, well, why is it wrong? It's just like that, which is just like that. And you get to, for those of you who are mathematically inclined, right, you can add infinitesimals, right, and eventually if you add infinitesimals, you can get infinity. Right, but there has to be some way where you can say that even though the difference between zero and infinity can be counted as an infinite number of 0.001s, right? Then nonetheless, right, there has to be a way you can draw a line. Okay, the second example I was going to bring, perhaps not fair with Rabbanita Kaczynski here, so I'm going to skip it largely. We should have a whole longer conversation about this. Was about the issue of the presence of Beitin at the mikveh, where that was actually going to get you to Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch says plainly that the position of the Rambam and the Rif is that, the position of the Rambam and the Rif seems to be that there is some kind of what I would call a super bedi'avad, where if you go to mikvah without the Beitin present, your children are still valid Jews, which means that on some level, really, the tefillah helped and the person really is converted and only some kind of barriers were interposed rabbinically. Whereas if you look at the Rambam, that's an impossible position to hold. The Rambam says explicitly that's not true, and that the Rambam only believes that the interpretation of the Gemara is that under certain circumstances we would treat the fact that somebody immersed as evidence that they must have at some previous time immersed before a Beit Din. So if one wishes to take the position, which Rabbi Tikhachinsky advances, so it's a vision that works very well according to Shulchan Aruch, but works very badly if you look behind the Shulchan Aruch. So does that commit us to be? Do we want to be Shulchan Aruch Yidim, or do we want to be? Rishonim Yidim, and then we could have a larger argument about what it would be if what the Gemara really meant, which. Pardon?
Or inconsistent
Eden, right? So that's. But the underlying thesis that I want to set out is that it's not clear to me that we aren't, or I would say I would contend that dafka in whatever however you define the boundaries of modern orthodoxy now, there is probably more need of definition than there has been previously, because we are hitting a point of self-conscious methodological choices. And when you're making self-conscious choices, you have to have some kind of boundaries. Right? If you're just going along and I'm just doing it the way I've always done it, that's fine. And if your conception is that really all modern Orthodox halakha should do, and this we'll talk about in the panel, right, is just do things the way they were always done without, you know, that's great. But if you don't, if you think that really choices are being made, I think that there's more of a need to be conscious about what sorts of choices we're making and thinking about to what extent do we really want to be bound by the, say that, or how strong the default should be to follow the Shulchan Aruch, how strong the default should be to follow the original meaning of the Talmud. There are people who take extreme positions each way, right? I think the rabbis Yuder are the public embodiment of the position that one follows the what they understand to be the original meaning of the Talmud, you know, come what may. And they're interesting bedfellows. You know, Rav Herschel Schechter officially says, I can pull a Rabbi Lopatin, I guess, and you know, take somebody's position and use it in the extreme opposite way. Right? So Rav Schechter has said publicly that, yes, if there was an error, he would change all of halakha to match the error. He just has the proviso that he will almost never believe that any such error occurs. So it's...